Okay, thank you. I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me. So I'm going to talk about Dirac fermions and lattice in general. So I'll give a quick review. Start with a quick review of the various common formulations that people use and the issues that come with putting Dirac fermions on a lattice. This might be fairly familiar, of course, to the lattice people, but I'll still try to go through quickly a review of the common formulations, and then I'll talk about this new formulation that I've been working on recently called flavor-flavored fermions. So the idea is to discretize the continuum Dirac operator d slash on the lattice. The d slash is gamma mu e mu plus I g a mu. So g is the coupling, a is the gauge field. So of course the standard way Wilson introduced to discretize the gauge field is, well, so we have a spacetime lattice. Here with the lattice facing A, this is x and x plus mu. Gluons, of course, go on the links of the lattice here, so there's a u, mu of x, and u, mu of x. You can take it to be this path ordered product, ui, g interval, x to x plus mu. Yes, that's one way of imagining the gauge field. And then, so this is kind of a parallel transport, takes you from site x plus mu down to x. So you can define the actual parallel transport operator, t mu, which is just the u, mu would say x, and then delta function x, x plus mu. So that's the hop from site forward, site back, and then you multiply by the gauge length. So this is the parallel transport operator. And then with this, you can easily write down a naive discretization for the Dirac operator, which is just 1/2 gamma mu t mu minus t mu dagger. So this is the naive Dirac operator. So it's nice and simple, of course, but it has problems. The main one is, so if we look at this, say, the free case, so set the gauge lengths u all to 1, and look at this in momentum space. See, the momentum space, this has the form gamma mu I sine. So this is a periodic lattice, and you can have any periodic in time, but I'm just treating everything periodic for simplicity. So sine of AP mu. And so if you look at the propagators, 1 over this, the poles of the propagator are the physical quark states. And so, of course, if the p's are all 0, you get a pole there. But now if any of the p's are also pi, you would also get a pole. So for each, you get a pole when any p mu is either 0 or pi. And that's for each direction. So if you have 4 dimensions, you have 2 for each dimension, you get 16 double modes, 16 quark modes, but you want it just 1. So that's the main problem with the naive Dirac operator.
You want to keep writing the A's?
What?
Your A's.
In the I may drop them some, yeah. I'll try to put it when important, but yeah. Okay, so that's the basic problem that everyone's familiar with. So there are several ways to solve this, or at least work around it. First is staggered least the first that I'm reviewing wasn't the first. But the idea here is, if you look at the form of the naive Dirac operator, you can see that you can do a diagonalization and bring it into a form where the spin is diagonal. So if you take this gamma dagger of x, d staggered x, y, gamma y, where gamma is some operator, depending on the coordinates, it's just the spin. And there are many conventions, but one would be gamma 1, x1, gamma 2, x2, 3, x3, gamma 4, x4. That's one possibility. If you plug that in, you'll see that this now becomes spin diagonal. So this is equal to the identity in spin times some, like this should have been naive operator, times some new staggered Dirac operator that you get. And the staggered Dirac operator then is 1/2 theta nu times t mu times t mu dagger. And the eta are some new phase factors you get. So eta nu of x is 1/4 trace of gamma dagger x, gamma u, and gamma y. So that's the staggered Dirac operator. Once you have this in the spin diagonal form, of course you realize that these are redundant, so you can just take one of the four copies. You get the staggered operator. This describes now four firm flavors, which is better, but still more than you want. So now if you consider the partition function, integral of du, in partition function you have the determinant, so stagger a times m, some gauge action, so if you just threw this into the partition function, you get four flavors, of course. So the way to get around this is to put a 1/4 there. If the flavors were really independent, this would be fine. They're not. They're mixed. So of course, there's some error in this, and it's been the source of much debate for many years. But the general kind of agreement consensus now is that this is fine in the continuum limit, and mainly
that's it's, your book.
Well, yeah. So as long as you're careful enough that you take
in all of Brookhaven or just one office?
Particularly one office.
You take A to 0 first, and then take M to 0. So you're careful to keep the mass large in some scale compared to A. Take that order of limits, then everything should work out. This should at least reproduce QCD. This is nice because you got rid of the spin, so it's a cheaper operator, very cheap to implement. Of course, you have to deal with a fourth root, but that's not so bad. And one other nice property, of course, is that it satisfies chiral symmetry. So d slash gamma 5, so this is the continuum, that's the continuum chiral symmetry. So staggered has its own version, typically using this operator written epsilon, which is -1, the sum of x. So one on even sites, -1 on odd sites. And so this operator anti-commutes with the staggered Dirac operator. So it has its own version of chiral symmetry, which is nice. And so that protects the mass, so the mass doesn't get any additive normalization. But then, of course, the drawback with still using the staggered operator for observables is that you have the four flavors, even though you get rid of it in the partition function. So observables have the four tastes there, flavors, that you have to deal with somehow, and that just complicates the observables. Makes them ugly is the proper term. Okay. Okay, so that's staggered. So you still, you keep, you have some of the doublers. You can sort of remove it, but it's ugly. It's very cheap, which is nice. But and it has a nice, has a remnant, has a version of chiral symmetry. So another one is Wilson. The approach here is you take, start with the naive Dirac operator, and you add some term, Wilson term. And this is like a mass term, so you want to give mass to all the doublers, make them heavy, but preserve the one light mode. And so the Wilson operator is this, and write this in momentum space, sum of mu, one minus cosine. So you can see this, if p is 0, this gives 0. And then if p is pi, this will give a 2. So you get a 2 for each factor of pi in here. And since we're comparing this to the quark mass, comes in as am, you get a 2 here, you can get it am. So your mass is effectively 2 over a. So the doublers go up to the cutoff. But then, of course, in real space on the lattice, this is 1/2 t mu plus t mu dagger. When you put in the gauge fields, so the gauge fields get normalized essentially. So this operator at zero momentum won't exactly be zero. So of course you get this additive mass correction, and that's also because this operator doesn't commute with gamma 5. So it breaks chiral symmetry, so you don't have the protection of the additive normalization to the quark mass. So Wilson is still fairly cheap, though. It's essentially 2 to 4 times or so of staggered. It is one flavor, but the downside is you break chiral symmetry. You get this additive mass correction, which isn't so bad because the quark masses aren't, quarks aren't massless anyway, so you just tune that. But in general, it has larger lattice spacing errors than staggered. Okay. So that's Wilson. And then the last major one that's used in production is Ginsburg-Wilson type. Comes in the overlap and the main wall varieties. So this is very nice. Of course, the basic idea is for overlap. So if you look at the eigenvalues of the Wilson-Dirac operator, they look roughly like this. This is in the free case, something like this. So this is 0. This would be your mass. You have these very nice lines crossing the real axis. This is the physical modes. There's one physical quark flavor here. You get 4 here, 6, 4, 1. These are all the doubler modes that got pushed off to be heavy. This is the free case. In the interacting case, of course, this all gets pushed in, and this becomes a lot fuzzier. So it all kind of gets smeared in, and now you don't have a very clear mass here. This is the additive mass normalization. But the overlap kind of cures this by picking a point somewhere in here, in this eye of the first one, and now you do a unitary projection around that point. So you project this onto a unitary, you shift this, so you have a new kernel, dw naught, which is the Wilson operator minus some m naught. So you shift this negative, and you project around this operator, and the eigenvalues just go to a unitary circle. And so this is using dw naught times dw naught dagger dw naught minus 1/2. for the unitary projection. So the eigenvalues go nicely to a circle. There's the one physical mode down here, and your 15 other doubler modes went up here. And then now you just add a 1 to this again to shift this back to make this 0, and that gives you a nice one-flavor massless Dirac operator. So this is the overlap operator here. So it gives you a nice one flavor, and the, I guess, nice property of this is it satisfies this Ginzburg-Wilson relation, so it has a version of chiral symmetry, you can write as, write in terms of the propagator, so 1 over the overlap operator commutes, well, anti-commuting with gamma 5 gives 2 gamma 5. So it's not 0, but this could be in general some local operator here, typically taken to be just a constant or ultra-local. If we put in the A's here, so this is in physical units, then this would be proportional to A. So now as the last facing goes to 0, the chiral symmetry breaking goes to 0. So in the chiral limit, it has, in the continuum limit, it restores chiral symmetry. And even on a finite lattice, it has a modified version of chiral symmetry. So there's good chiral properties, one flavor. And the main downside, of course, is it's just expensive. You have to do this inverse square root for overlap. The main wall is an approximation of that. You add a fifth dimension, you approximate the inverse square root with a rational function. So it's cheaper, but it's an approximation. Potential issue with this inverse square root is that of locality. This has been studied, and it seems that this operator, so it's not ultra-local like Staggart and Wilson are, but it seems to be local enough, meaning that the Dirac operator falls off like an exponential. And that's good enough to be give you a local operator in the continuum limit.
Let it's units. The important thing is this is in lattice units. It falls exponentially in lattice units rather than physically. If it was in physical units, then it would be non-local because it would have a range in the physical.
Yeah. And so this Ginzburg-Wilson operator then, this modified chiral symmetry was important. So this gets around this no-go theorem, the Nielsen-Neumeier. No-go theorem, which essentially says you can't have a one-flavor chiral and local operator on the lattice. So one of these has to give. And so here they have a modified, they break that very softly, and that still satisfies this theorem. Okay. So that's the review. So there's a few more variations. So there's many other lattice Dirac operators people have come up with. I won't mention them all. But there's a few others that I wanted to mention that are just interesting that people are still working on now. I don't think they're used in production, but people are studying them more. Of course, one is minimally doubled. The idea here is the no-go theorem says you can't have a one-flavor chiral operator, but you can have two flavors. That doesn't break the theorem. So you can get an n equals 2 operator that satisfies chiral symmetry exactly, obvious principle. However, the formulations of this that people are looking at so far end up breaking other symmetries, so hypercubic symmetry, for example. And that means you have to add counterterms to fine-tune and restore that in the continuum limit. So people are studying this, still active field, but I don't think anyone's using it yet. There's Staggart-Wilson. Which is what it sounds like. It's you take the staggered Dirac operator and you add a Wilson term. Staggered Dirac operator, this is a staggered Wilson term. It works fine for two flavors. You can find an operator that you can add that makes two of the flavors heavy and keeps the two light. It doesn't break any other symmetries. Of course, it's still Wilson, so you still have to tune the mass. It's like Wilson. But that works okay. One flavor operator, you can find ones that will keep one light and make the other three heavy, but they break rotational symmetry. So they also have extra symmetries they break that require some fine-tuning. And then, of course, another thing you can do with this is staggered overlap. And it's, again, what it sounds like. You take the staggered Wilson operator, plug it into the overlap equation, and you get an overlap operator out of it. And again, it's the same issue with staggered Wilson. For two flavors, it's fine. You don't break any other symmetries. So then the overlap formulation would restore the chiral symmetry. So you get a two-flavor operator that has this approximate chiral symmetry. And then, of course, for the one-flavor operator, it breaks the hypercubic symmetry.
Why would you do that? What is the advantage of staggered
overlap? The idea is that if you wanted a two-flavor operator anyway, it's cheaper. So you've lost your spin degrees of freedom, so it's a cheaper operator. But yeah, you still have the square
except
root.
Except that the W term is not that cheap as the staggered case.
Oh, because it goes across the.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know what the. I think it's still supposed to be cheaper. Okay, so then I talk about the version I've been looking at, which is a different approach to all of these, essentially. Flavor filtered fermions, that's what I'm calling it. And the basic idea is if you look at the naive propagator, instead of, say, doing what Wilson does, add a term here to make this massive, I'm going to attempt to just multiply by some operator, some filter. F that will filter out the doublers without breaking chiral symmetry directly. And so this, you write the operator in this way, this still has chiral symmetry exactly. And so it's an example, one possibility for the filter. You know, in the free case in momentum space, you could write this as the product over mu 1 plus cosine. One half, for example. And so clearly this, if the p's are all 0, this will give you 1. 1 if p mu are all mu. And if any of the p's are pi, this will give a factor of 0, multiply it through. So if any of the p mu pi for some mu. So at least in the free case, you know, that would work nicely. Filter out the doublers, keep the one physical mode you want. And it's also nice and cheap, because this is just a naive Dirac operator you're inverting. It's you can also do the spin diagonalization and write it as four staggered solves. So it's just the cost of four staggered solves. So this, as it's written though, this is the problem, because if the filter were 0, when you invert this to get the Dirac operator, it would be divergent. So what we do is we appeal now to the Ginsburg-Wilson relation. And so instead of having the exact chiral symmetry, we have the approximate chiral symmetry. And so we can write this very simply. As the operator, we add a constant, call it rho, plus this f. And I'll put in the mass term now. So we just simply add a constant to this. That's the constant that appears in the Ginsburg-Wilson relation. So it satisfies the Ginsburg-Wilson relation. This helps regulate it, so now you invert. Oh, sorry, this was the inverse. So the propagator, we add the constant to. So when you invert this, this helps regulate it, so you don't have the exact pole there. I put the mass in just naively, putting as the usual naive Dirac operator. There could be other ways of putting this. You could put other operators, and there's even other ways of doing it. But this is the simplest, and it works fine. So seems to be the best choice. You can write the inverse of this to find out what the operator itself looks like. This is 1 over rho minus 1 over rho f. Rho n plus m plus f dagger f inverse f dagger. So this is one way of writing the Dirac operator itself. This is the easiest way. So it's just a constant, and then you subtract off this piece is the filter. This is the inverse of some other operator. Comes the filter again. So this is the naive Dirac operator plus this filter becomes essentially effective mass here.
Rho is arbitrary?
Rho was. That's the constant term that you'd have.
That's the usual rho in the Ginsburg-Wilson?
The Ginsburg-Wilson. Yeah.
It's not restricted to any range.
In principle, it could be any local operator, even. It doesn't have to be a constant.
Right, but it's a constant and it's arbitrary positive constant. There is no range.
Well, it'll vary your the form of the operator. So it's an optimization issue.
There is no restriction on it. Yeah.
Not a priori. I don't think so.
And not like in the Ginsburg-Wilson operator where rho has to be between like 0 and 2 or something. And some units.
It's not this shift or anything like that. It's just an overall scale factor. Which is an overall constant. Yeah. If it were too large, then you can see when I write this in another form, it's gonna affect the proportion between this term and this term. And so if you make it too large or too small one way, you just won't get a suitable operator, at least on a regular finite lattice. Roughly around 1. I think actually half is the one I've been taking, but that was just arbitrary. I haven't tried tuning it.
That bracket still looks like, after taking the inverse, like a 1 over d instead of a d.
Yes, this is the best way to write it so I don't have to take an inverse of the filter itself. There's the subtraction here. If you kind of naively work it out, assuming everything commutes, what you're... I have another form to show it. But you'll... If you naively work it out, you would get the Dirac operator divided by the Dirac operator.
So if I say rho d naive plus m is small compared to f dagger f into a Taylor series expansion in my head, I'll get d. I see that now.
It looks something like an operator with a polyvalars regularization. So it's the ratio of two Dirac operators, really.
And it has the correct classical limit for any rho. It is gamma mu p mu, is a leading term in the momentum space.
Let's say I don't have that exactly written, but
okay,
if we just naively assume everything commute and pull it through, actually there's another way to write it. If I define an operator, some kernel, which is f, it's probably f f dagger inverse dn plus m f inverse. I don't like to write it this way because f is singular, but if you ignore that and still write with this kernel, then this operator can also be written as dk over dk plus, I guess it's 1, it's rho dk plus 1. So this is essentially Poivre's regularization. If the filter where it goes 0, this blows up, but this regulates it and keeps it as 1 over rho for the doubler modes. If this is 1, this is small, you get the regular Dirac mode. This is small, this gives you 1, this gives you the regular physical Dirac mode. Okay. So, So the first, there are a few issues, questions you have. One is how well you actually filter. This is in the free case, but in the intracking case, the filter won't be exact. It's one issue. The other is locality. Is it local? So let's look at locality first. So clearly, d slash has this form of a propagator in it, this inverse. So it will have some exponential fall off long range. If you look at structure with some pion mass determined essentially by this operator, by the input bare quark mass, and then this effective mass from the filter. So you can see, of course, as what you're trying to do is make the filter small for 15 of the modes. And that would make this small. So for those 15 modes, you do have this long range mode in the d slash. So there's that long range exponential. But then you have, if this is small for those 15 doublers, then this is small in front too. So the amplitude is also small. And so it's sort of competing there. But if we just naively estimate this, so if we take f dagger f, and just consider this for the doubler modes and just take a naive estimate, we write this as some a times some mass, mf. So assuming we can tune it and so on, we get some mass that we're assuming that's proportional to a here. We just kind of naively plug this in for the Dirac operator and look at the exponential fall off in terms of this pion mass. So if we assume that this filter mass here, the effective mass, we're going to assume that this is just very small. We're going to assume that that's much smaller than your quark mass anyway, which is what you would want. So for this exponential mass here, I'm just going to put in the pion mass for that fall off, for that correlator, and just assume this is very small, but then I'm just going to have this naive factor up front. So if you do that, you would say that the Dirac operator falls off as, this is bounded really, from x to y, bounded by a, mf, over rho, just e to the minus, m pi, x minus y, over 2. So it's an issue, certainly, because if you would fix this into physical units, you have a physical pion mass, of course, not massless, but light. If you wanted to really go to an infinite volume, this is a long-range mode that would appear. And if you fix everything or fix the last spacing everything first and really go to large distance, this is your mass. And it's a light mode if you have a light pion.
But so in the continuum limit, does it fall off
so
exponentially, or you say this is a physical fall off?
This is physical. Yeah.
But it doesn't become a local operator.
Then it's not local.
In the continuum limit.
So
it goes to zero.
Yeah, so the thing is, if you wanted to go to an infinite volume at fixed lattice spacing, then definitely there's a long-range mode in this. So the question is, though, of course, you don't go to infinite lattices, right? Is it still, can you find a range where it's good enough that this is suppressed, for if you pick your physical volume, which is all you need based on your pion mass, right? You don't need to go any larger than that. So you fix the physical volume, fix the physical pion mass. Now you have this coefficient out front, A and MF here. But this is how well you tune the filter. So the question is, can you suppress this at fixed physical values enough by tuning things? I mean, if you could tune this perfectly, you can make this essentially go to zero. So the question is, how good is good enough? Can I tune things well enough so that I can suppress this, that on my fixed physical lattice size, fix the physical parameters. This is a free parameter here that I can tune. And then, it's also related to the lattice spacing too, but the question is, can I tune this well enough that I suppress this to make it negligible? And I don't know what that, there has to be some standard of what negligible is.
But in the continuum limit, you have a non-local theory.
Well, it depends on this, what you can do with that.
But if you can, rho is 8 times something too, or?
Rho is just a constant. That doesn't matter.
I think that, it is really a yes or no question, actually, I think. For the overlap, for example, everything is in the free operator. The reason everything is local in overlap is that the momentum space representation of overlap is analytic in the momenta, in some region of the complex momenta. So you can go away to complex momenta and still have analyticity. Everything, if you add gauge fields, everything is better, more local than that. So basically the answer for overlap is because it's analytic, then it's local. So in your case, why don't you just write the in momentum space and see if it's an analytic function of momentum, and then if it's analytic, then it's local, and it's not, then it's doubtful that it's going to be local.
Yeah, I looked at that some, but it's related to this issue of how well you can suppress this. This is an arbitrary term.
Well, I think I see there is a freedom in this F.
Yeah.
But as a question, so in the free case, can you make choice of F such that you get analytic expression? If you can, then it's done basically, and you don't need anything else.
Yeah. I haven't looked at that carefully.
But so when you say analytic, it has to follow, right?
But analyticity in the complex P moment P space implies exponential follow. So that's equivalent. So we just see whether you can go into. So you don't get some pole in complex for complex P, but if that pole is in the complex plane, is the non, away from the away from imaginary part being zero, then it's fine. Essentially, the rate of fall off is how complex it can, where this pole lives.
Yeah, but so I was concentrating on the interacting case, thinking that that's the free case would be too simple.
No.
But it's, you so really think that the interacting case,
if you're short working in a momentum space, you are done.
I don't know. I thought it was more important to look at this. But
if you don't have it there, then forget it. That's the thing. If it doesn't work out in the free case, then it's not gonna work.
Well. No, because there's this arbitrary tuning, though.
Well,
and that so that's
as I said, if you cannot find a tuning which makes it local in the free case, then it's not going.
Okay. I mean, the free case, I'm not putting in any tuning because I don't need to, but.
I mean choice of F, no? Mm-hmm.
I'm going to show later I'm putting in some coefficients to actually allow me to play with this for the interacting case. Well, So the thing is, I think the statement, though, is that, I mean, certainly you have this long-range mode. That's clear.
That's suspicious. If you say that you have this long-range mode, then that's, I don't know whether it's going to...
But then I have this unknown coefficient. And so the question is, can I suppress this enough to make this... I mean, if this were completely arbitrary, I could push it down as much as I want. So the question is, how much can I actually push this down?
But that's so it's an inherent continuum limit.
What happens when the log of spacing goes to zero? So there is also...
Well, I put a naive A here, but that's assuming that I can keep this small.
But do I have also implicit dependence on A in that formula, in that bound? So what's happening?
This was just a simple, naive expansion. But, it hinges on this tuning. So there's a fine-tuning, naively, that would happen in here that I'm going to talk about in the spectrum. But yeah, I mean, it's related to this critical issue of how well you can actually make this small.
So if I meet that bound, what would be the limit when A goes to zero? Can I see the limits
in
the bound?
I assume this. So in my assumption here, I pulled out an A. Mm-hmm. That's mainly because I wanted to assume that I could make this smaller than the AN in here. Assuming I were in that limit, then naively there's an A here. But that requires some work to actually get this.
So this bound, is it actually saturated? Do you know it's saturated?
So I looked at this on quench lattices.
Okay.
So there's kind of a constant local behavior. It drops very rapidly. It has a bit of a dip, goes down, and then there's this long range tail. So the drop-off immediately is a very fast exponential, and that is roughly some lattice spacing. That goes with the lattice spacing. But then this tail here is related to the pion mass, assuming that the filter is tuned to be very small, I'm assuming. But so that is the kind of physical long-range tail that you have. And so the question is, what is this coefficient? How well you can tune it? Can I arbitrarily make it so that if I were to tune it so that it goes like this or so on, how much would I have to suppress this for, you pick your lattice size, pick your pion mass, how small do I have to make this before this is a negligible contribution to the final result?
Why is it the pion mass? I mean, does this operator clearly couple to pions?
This is just the drive. I'm just saying that this is, the magnitude, the norm squared of the Dirac operator. This is, if I assume this has a negligible contribution, this is just the pion mass, it's the lightest state.
But there's a gamma phi that in.
No, this is just naive Dirac factors. Rho is just a constant.
It's the lightest state.
Yeah, but it has to be in the pseudo scalar channel. No?
If I take the magnitude of the Dirac operator, that's just the lightest state. So that's. Mm-hmm. This is a question of how well you can tune this, and I don't know the answer to this question either. If I had a Dirac operator that in principle has this non-local behavior, but with an arbitrary coefficient in front, how small do I have to make that coefficient in order to ignore this? I don't know.
I don't think you can.
On a finite lattice, if I can make this arbitrarily small, at some point it's not going to contribute. Right?
So in the interacting case, what do we actually use for that?
Yeah, I'll get to that in a bit.
You can gauge this easily, actually. This expression can be gauged. This 1 plus cosine AP mu.
Yeah, I'll get to that. But I don't understand why. I mean. Hypothetically, suppose I make this 10 to the minus 10. If I had a constant, if I added a constant to my Dirac operator and make it, 10 to the minus 20 or something. At some point, it's got to be small enough that it's not going to contribute to my result. Now, maybe it has to be too small. I don't know.
So these locality constraints are right. kind of fuzzy, you know. It comes yeah. from universality, you know. So people say that, I mean, from yeah. RG group, you know, if things are exponentially local, you know, then you can do RG transformation and assume that things will still be local in that sense. You know, it's sort of self-contained.
Yeah, okay.
Self-contained way of doing things, which guarantee.
But that was.
It's probably too strong, actually.
Yeah, it's
probably
suspicion.
Too strong.
Yeah.
But nobody knows what is, you know, what is.
Yeah.
The,
So I mean, I think in principle, you could take a term like this, say that you have a term like this added to your Dirac operator, and you should. There should be some way. To work out, you know, what the error due to this is, or essentially the same thing, how small you have to make this to make it less than, you know, a tenth of a percent error, right? And that must be, there must be something. Now maybe it's too small. I don't know.
Yeah, you know, maybe it's fruitful, but I'm afraid we will run into, you know, similar sort of, you know, objections as the
no,
as
the, certainly
as,
yeah.
the, as the routing and things like
yeah.
that.
Yeah, so I think, you know, the key issue though still is how small you can make this, and that's the fundamental key issue with this formulation. Okay, so.
So, in the bracket for df, should there be a minus one somewhere, like rho? So the rho time. The n plus m, should there be a minus one, the inverse of that?
No, that was my expression inverted. So minus one here.
Yeah, like imagine rho is small.
Well, yeah, imagine m is large.
No, imagine rho is small, then
then I have
then you can expand that bracket, the first order in rho in your head. You'll see that the f's cancel out, the constant term cancels the constant term, and you're left with the Lewis m.
I did a large m expansion, it goes whatever.
Yeah, I think, I mean, this is a nice way to think of it in terms of this.
Quark mass is large, would you mean?
Operator, you know, this is f inverse dm is an f. In that kernel you write it as this form with essentially polyvalars regulation.
The zero filter, you cannot be using
this
So that was a bit of bad news. Before I get to the filtering, we should talk about topology, which actually looks like a nice thing. There are, you know, gauge fields in the background of some instanton or something. You can have a, you know, exact zero modes of the Dirac operator. And the problem with, say, you know, naive or staggered, the eigenvalues are always paired. So if you have, you know, you have a minus I pair and plus I eigenvalue pair, the two can get small. They won't quite get to zero. But in principle, if they could go to zero, you would get two zero modes. You can't get a single zero mode out of naive. But what I did, I looked at this operator, the eigenvalues of this Dirac operator, just on an eight to the fourth lattice, just a quenched lattice, a beta 5.8. So if you're quenched, beta is 5.8 and a mass of 0.01, just something I chose that. And I looked at a few configurations. You know, they didn't all show something, but this is a picture of one that looked very nice. So you start with look at the naive operator first. So that's essentially this Dirac operator, but making the filter be just one instead of what it should be. And so that's essentially just the naive Dirac operator, except it's projected onto this, you know, unitary circle. So for the, you know, this would be the mass m, just some kind of curve. And so the, you know, naive eigenvalues all along this curve, and they're symmetric, of course, like that. Now I, you know, turn on the filter, set it to be as roughly this, it's slight variation. But then look at the eigenvalues. There's an overall shift in the eigenvalues that occurs, so I just scale by an overall constant to make it roughly fall in this line again. And because, so this operator, you know, has the chiral symmetry at zero mass, so it falls on the unitary circle at zero mass. But when the mass is non-zero, that breaks the chiral symmetry, and it does it in a way that the eigenvalues actually spread out. They don't fall on that circle anymore. So the eigenvalues kind of spread out a bit, but many of them still follow close to this line. In particular, what happens is there's one eigenvalue. It's exactly zero here. The eigenvalues are still paired in real pairs. So there's one there and one, it's real pair, out there. And then there was another set of eigenvalues, roughly like this. Again, they come in pairs always. So there were 15 eigenvalues that sat out here. So you can see the one real zero mode fell along the line, and there's 15 others that seem like they want to be heavy, and they're possibly being pushed off to be heavier. And the hope then would be that, you know, if you could go to the continuum limit, you would get this one exact zero mode that survived, and the other 15 would get pushed off. Of course, that needs to be verified, but you know, this happens only because I have a large mass. If the mass went to zero, then everything would just collapse back onto this curve. So this requires the non-zero mass to allow things to be complex. And so I guess the hope would be that if you take the limit, A goes to zero first, then M to zero, or at least, you know, M small, in that limit you might recover the correct topology. So of course this needs to be verified, but that was very interesting. It looks like, you know, there's a chance that this does see topology correctly. Okay. Let me go back to the middle. Okay, so now we're back to the issue of exactly how well you can get this to remove the doublers. And so we've looked at this two ways. One is just in the valence sector, so just using this is a valence operator looking at meson masses and see how well we can suppress the doubler modes there. And then we're also starting to look at, you know, if you were actually to do a dynamical simulation, how well you could remove them, but we don't have any real results for that yet. So you take this operator on the lattice. The way we implement it, the moment we symmetrize the product over mu, so over all permutations of mu to keep it rotationally symmetric. And we're implementing it as 1 minus alpha, so parameter alpha plus alpha over 2 plus d dagger. And so we put in this constant alpha because, you know, this is sort of in relationship to tadpole improvement. You know, this gets renormalized. We can kind of just use a single parameter as a simple way to tune it and attempt to bring it back so that this will cancel out. So the naive value would be alpha equals 0.5. That would correspond to this, you know, the operator we had in the free case. And then when you turn on the gauge fields, we have to make alpha a little larger to help correct that. So this is how we've implemented so far, just testing this one parameter tuning to see how well that works. In principle, if you wanted to do this fully, you could multiply this whole thing out in terms as group it into the number of hops. So you can have a term f naught, which is the terms just with no hops, just a constant. And f1, which has the terms with one hop, f2, two hops, three hops, and four hops. So there are five operators. This goes in, and you know, these all have all the permutations associated with them. So there are five operators that you can get from this. And if you were to go to an effective theory, semantic effective theory in principle, there would be, again, corresponds to these five operators. There would be five terms in your effective action that you would have to tune. So we get the coefficients in all five of these and do the tuning arbitrarily. But we haven't tried that yet. Actually, there are five coefficients, but what's most important is the ratios to get the doubler's light. So really only, and then you know, the fifth would be just to set the mass of the physical one, which doesn't need to be as finely tuned. So really it's four parameters that would have to be finely tuned. So what we've done, so we looked at this in the valence sector. We took some quench lattices, 32 cubed by 64 quench lattices, and just measured the meson spectrum, so pions, and looked at the, you know, did fits to all of the doubler pions. So we threw all of the non-local pions, kind of like staggered, but for naive. So we put in any arbitrary shift and arbitrary phase factor, so we can get, in principle, all 256 pions. You know, there's 16 quarks, so we have 256 pions we can produce out of that. We do all the non-local pions, measure all these, you know, categorize them into the ones that should be physical states and the ones that are made up of, you know, at least one doubler quark. We do fits to these to find their amplitude and mass, and then we can define the suppression ratio. So we, you know, we fit every state minus mt, and then we define a suppression factor called s, which is just the maximum of the amplitude for the doubler, for a doubler, a pion with a doubler quark over the physical one. So it's the maximum amplitude for any of the doubler quarks. And we looked at this for a variety of combinations. So the results here are all for a 32 cubed by 64 lattice. So it's beta 6.4. This was just a plain plaquette action, no improvement, quenched. And so this, if this were QCD, this would correspond to a lattice spacing of about 0.054 Fermi. But it, you know, it's just quenched. So then we looked at a few cases. So one is just setting alpha to a half, just the naive value, so no tuning. And here we get suppression of about 10 to the minus 2. So the doublers are suppressed by about a factor of 100.
Well,
so,
what is the interpolation field?
Sorry?
Did you fit the all 256 excited state, or did you use different operators?
We use all the staggers. So we put shifts and phase factors at the source and sink. So we're doing all the non-local pions. So that way we can
like
separate.
It's
similar to doing this for staggered, yeah.
Because it's something to this.
And then, but yeah, we also have a gamma. We have a spin, so we put in all the spin matrices too. That are, and then we identify the ones that are pions out of that combination.
Okay, so the n is no four, not four components, one component spin out.
This is naive operator. So it has spin.
And so you see nice exponential decays in time for all of these states?
Even just, you know, we look at first with the naive, and there, of course, you have these wild, the oscillating states due to the staggered.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as we turn on the filter, even just, a half, I mean, they're suppressed. They're not completely gone. You can see some little wiggles, mm-hmm. but they're mostly suppressed already. I mean, this is 10 to the minus 2, which, you know, visually, if you look at that, that's a huge difference. You can already tell that it's nearly gone. So if we tune it a little bit, kind of a coarse grain tuning, 0.5 to 4.
So, sorry, what is the value? Do you extract many M's also?
We would have, yeah, independent fits. We'd have this for every fit, too. The masses, I don't know the range, but I mean, they're staggered masses, so there's some variation in the mass, too. These are all independent fits.
Mm-hmm. So you have a light pion and then heavier states, or what does the spectrum look like?
You have all the states you would have in a naive operator, but now we're suppressing the ones that are related to doublers, essentially.
You're suppressing the amplitude, but not the mass.
Yeah.
What are you saying?
Yeah, the amplitude. Yeah, we're looking.
So getting heavier?
No, they don't get heavier. They're suppressed.
Oh, yeah, a few times.
That's, yeah. So, again, it's the thing. They're there, it's just they're suppressed. So that, it's sort of the same issue. We're not making them heavy. We're trying to filter them out. So it's a different approach. So you tune it, to 0.54. There, the suppression is about 3 times 10 to the minus 4.
So just to make it clear, so there you have 256 pions, and they all have the same mass.
Staggered pions don't have the same mass.
There would be four copies of the staggered pattern.
Okay.
Depending on how big the taste or whatever breaking is at this particular body spacing.
It's.
But if
the naive Dirac operator has the properties of four identical copies of staggered quarks, and so you just get. So when you then put them two of them together, you get basically not 4 times, 16 times. The pattern that you would measure it.
It's 1, 4, 6, 4, 1 pattern. Would it not jeopardize to make it confused by it?
So they have different.
So there's more that goes on.
Four patterns. It isn't. Could have been some time. We don't have that.
I thought the pairing is that pattern, no?
Within the stagger thing, yes, exactly.
You
have 16 centers.
You
have 16 times this stagger, where you have the heaviest, lightest.
Foamstone taste, et cetera, et cetera.
So what we're doing, we're starting with this, we look at the naive first, and then we say that's four copies of staggered, so you have the 16 degenerate versions of staggered. But then you can watch those flow as you turn on, you gradually start with alpha equals 0 and turn on the filter, go up to a half, those flow. What actually happens, those that are staggered pions originally aren't all pions when we turn on the filter, because we broke in all of this symmetry. We have to re-identify what is a pion in here. But we're identifying the pions in this thing. In this operator, since we've broken the staggered symmetries, the spin is determined just by the spin gamma that you put in. The shifts, if you put a shift operator in the source or sink, makes no difference, just like an overlap. That's just a smearing of the source. So those are all just other physical copies of that same operator. What matters is the phase factor. Once you put in the phase factor, now, since these were all, it's supposed to be just a single flavor, that's canceling things out, and those are what get suppressed because of the phase factor gives you the suppression and amplitude, and those correspond to the doubler modes. So all of those states with the phase factor are the ones that disappear, and it's not the same counting that you would get exactly back in the naive picture. So we do a little more fine-tuning, 5, 3, 5, 2, helps a little bit. You can get down to about 10 to the minus 4.
There cannot be any additional mixing that is not there in the naive case due to the filtering between the different modes. No. That somehow these amplitudes are superposition because I have some mixing between the different states due to the breaking of some symmetry. I don't know. I'm just asking
Yeah, I mean they're just naively suppressed. So this is just with the plane. This was, you know, again, just the plane unimproved plaquette action, so fairly coarse, fairly rough. So we also tried turning on stout smearing. This is just not in the generation, but just on top in the valence sector. We do two steps of stout smearing. And now with the naive alpha 0.5, we get S to be about 3 times 10 to the minus 4. So without any tuning, we already get something like the coarse tuning there. And if we try to really tune this well, so 0.50615, we can get down to about 10 to the minus 6. And at that point, you know, even though we're doing all the non-local pion stuff, all the Doppler modes, you know, they're suppressed enough that they're essentially just noise. We can't really fit to these anymore. So at least in the valence sector, with some tuning and of course stout improvement helps a lot, you can pretty easily eliminate all the Doppler modes so that they don't really enter the analysis at all. You can just treat it as just a single flavor of an overlap type operator. But that's the valence sector. This was easier. There's actually no fine-tuning that happens in the valence sector, mainly because this is just a naive suppression of the operator. You know, F is just out front. We're just comparing it to 1, essentially. You know, in the filter, and when we turn on the gauge fields, we expect that this, for the doubler modes, this naively will be, you know, instead of 0, will be proportional to G squared. And so, you know, there are two factors of that here. So naively, we expect the suppression to already be G to the fourth, roughly. And that's just compared to 1. There's no other factor of A that we're fighting. So there's no fine tuning necessary. We can just, this will just naturally be small. And by tuning it, we can make it even smaller. So the problem comes in the dynamical sector. So if we rewrite the determinant of this operator, so inside the determinant, you can kind of rearrange things and move things around. And you can write this now as naive. So the ratio of the naive operator to this other operator with the filter in it. So that's the fermion determinant. So you can view this operator in the partition function as being just the naive operator with all 16 flavors divided by, essentially quenched, by this modified operator. It's naive plus the filter. Again, the filter is trying to be small for 15 of the flavors. 15 of the flavors will get approximately quenched. And then the one that gets heavy here will not get quenched. And so it's a partial quenching of 15 of the 16 naive fermion modes. So now the problem here, so there would be A here, really. Problem is now we're comparing the filter essentially to this quark mass here. So the filter, you know, even though it naively, say, goes as G to the fourth, we're making this an effective mass. And so really what we're up against now is that G to the fourth over A is the effective mass that comes from here. And so now there's a fine tuning. So that's kind of the fundamental question again, is, you know, with some of these tricks, you know, putting in all the coefficients or even just, you know, the one parameter or using four parameter tuning, can you tune this well enough that you can make this essentially a good enough quenching of the 15 flavors that you could say do dynamical? And so we're starting to look at this by looking at the meson spectrum of this operator here, so with the filter. So again, we can measure all the non-local pions. In particular, we're interested in the 16 diagonal mesons with the same quark from here. That will give us a handle on what the effective masses of this filter really are, and to see if we can control this enough to make them small compared to the input bare quark mass. But this is still ongoing. Okay, so that's roughly it. There's just two other quick things I wanted to mention. So we looked at the idea before of trying to get an improved operator without any fine-tuning. The question is, can you find a filter where you say take some function of this or do something to, instead of making it cosine, make it it's much more abrupt, more perfect filter without any tuning, even in the interacting case, by taking some polynomial of either the term inside here or taking some polynomial of the whole thing to try to give you the suppression directly without any need for tuning. What we were doing essentially is making this act more like a step function, and we could actually get very good suppression of the doublers without any fine tuning, but of course we make this more like a step function. That's really a momentum space, more like a step function. That makes it less local when you go back to real space. So there's a competition between getting it filtered well, in that case, of some improved filter, and making it less local. It's not clear that that would be worth it. Although there might be some way to get a happy medium between there. As one kind of silly idea, suppose you had a filter that went like the naive operator over the overlap operator. So this, the naive operator at all the 16 modes, quark modes, is going to be near zero. So essentially we'll filter out all the 16 modes. The overlap operator is going to be zero at the physical one and large at the other 15. So the physical mode, you have 0/0. You assume that this cancels out, gives you 1. That would give you 1 for the physical mode, but then it still remains 0 for the other 15 doubler modes. Of course, this is a silly choice because if you're throwing the overlap operator, you should just do overlap. But it's interesting, at least, that there conceptually could be operators that give you something nice. And, in a way, you could even relate this to overlap if you wanted. This isn't really practical, but maybe there's some approximation of this that's cheap enough that makes it reasonable. And then the last thing I want to mention is, okay, so we started with a naive operator, but you could do the same thing with staggered. Suppose I started with a staggered operator, and propagate that and find some filter in the staggered space that could take the staggered four flavors and filter out some of the flavors. It's similar to the staggered Wilson case, that you can easily come up with an operator that will remove 2 of the flavors, take you down to 2 flavors without breaking any other symmetries. But if you want to go down to 1 flavor, you're just going to break rotational symmetry. But in principle, you could do the same type of trick with a staggered operator. So that's it.
Have you tried? The thing that worries me is that you have this psi propagator and you have lots of modes, and some of them find they decouple. There is some limit in which they decouple. Anyhow, the fact that these modes decouple in the propagator doesn't necessarily mean that they couple in a loop. Because if you calculate, for instance, the self-energy contribution to the fermion propagator, you have at the internal line that is suppressed, then the loop with A, then the loop generates a divergence, like 1/A, if you're lucky, that A there gets multiplied times 1/A, and you get the order 1
contribution of these doublers to the fermions of energy, if you're lucky. If you're unlucky, you get an A squared, a 1 over A squared divergence times A, and you get a divergence in the self-energy.
Well, I think, I mean, the way to think of the partition function, you know, the full theory, the easiest way to think of it is this quenching. So for every loop you have of the fermion, you have the doubler, you know, the bosonic one, which should cancel if the masses are tuned well. If it's not, then you have some error with that, and so the error should be proportional to the mistuning, right? Well, okay, times some factor, times, yeah. But you can think of this as a partially quenched theory, I think is the most intuitive way to think of it. So the errors due to this are due to, you know, a mistuning in the partial quenching. So in principle, you could work that out. You'd have your loops, as you say, and then the ghost loops that go along with it. And that, you know, you could work out the full effective theory for this and in principle calculate the things.
Okay, in the sense you are saying that you don't want to use this operator in the generation of the configurations, but only in measuring the observables, is that the idea?
This is the same operator. I've just taken this determinant. It's just another way of rewriting it. It's the same operator. Yeah, I mean, for the valence sector, yeah, I mean, I'm using this operator here. But
no, I'm worried what happens when you use it to actually generate configuration, so when you use it in the action.
Yeah, in the action, it turns into this. You can rewrite it like this. And I think this is, you know, the more intuitive way to think of it.
Now, why would this make, I mean, what do you get from this way of writing it?
Well, you can think of it as a partially. So in this case, you could write this whole operator as a partially quenched theory. In that case, it is a ultra-local partially quenched theory you can write down. And so all these issues with the locality and, you know, whether you can cancel out the doublers are really come back to this, the fact that this underneath, it was kind of hidden at first. But you can really think of this whole thing as a partially quenched theory. Okay, the 16 naive fermions trying to be canceled by 15 of these. And all of the issues are with issues with how well you are quenching it or not. And in principle, you could write down the full partially quenched effective theory and calculate all of your, I mean, any quantity you want. And you would be able to calculate what the error is due to this mistuning. And so maybe that's another way to treat it. I mean, you have some extra parameters here. You can, in principle, if you could really do all the spectroscopy and everything, you can get all the parameters of the effective theory and try to use that to tune it or even maybe extrapolate it, assuming you can get control over the theory and make it small enough that you could get a proper limit. But, I mean, that's difficult, certainly.
So basically, from that point of view, right, you have your naive action, and then you introduce some ghost bosons, right, to write this ratio, right?
Yeah.
But that, now, what, so you can look at the field as defined by this action, right, if I understood you correctly.
Yeah.
But this action now might have some other issues, like do you maintain the positivity of the transfer matrix? Or you somehow you generate some dynamical poles that are like ghosts, real ghosts. You know? I'm not sure, for example, you know, this action probably is no longer reflection positive.
Yeah, possibly.
Especially when you have this, you know, bosonic
field. Basically, only the Wilson action is the only one that's reflection positive.
Start
mocking with it. Even adding a Clover term, it's not really.
There may be issues because of this form of the partial quenching, but at least the one nice thing about it is that, say, unlike a rooted staggered, I know what the effective theory is. I can write it down. And so you can study this in terms of the effective theory and learn what its pathologies are that way, too. and maybe try to find ways to work around it.
And the root of Sagard case, you know, also, no, you just put in 1/4 in front of them.
Yeah, they have. Yeah, actually, that's right. They have done that much more formally now too. Mm-hmm. That's true. But you can't just write it down. It's a prescription you have to do to fix things up, right?
Okay, but here you have an unlocal theory. So
I don't agree with what you said.
Your theory.
Well, this is a partially quenched ultra local. It's ultra local in the partially quenched sense. Mm-hmm. But that, yeah, of course, that leads to problems in the full theory.
It's partially quenched, is not unitary and all that stuff.
So I mean, yeah.
Yes.
But there's a framework you could study this anyway.
Yeah.